This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, the Supreme Court handed down its most debated, most anticipated, and most far-reaching rulings of the spring, and it's a split decision. The court took up two cases involving affirmative action and the University of Michigan. One covered admissions policies for the undergraduate school, and the other, the University of Michigan's law school. Both use affirmative action. An applicant's race is a factor in the decision to admit or not. In the case of the undergraduate school, the court found that the system that awarded minority applicants 20 points added up to a racial quota and was therefore unconstitutional. In the case of the law school, the court ruled that it was permissible to use race as one factor among many. Both decisions will be closely read not just in university admissions offices around the country, but in Fortune 500 boardrooms and in the Pentagon as well. Joining us now to talk about these important rulings are Doug Kamek, who's dean of the Catholic University Law School, a former constitutional legal counsel to President Reagan. He's with us by phone from his office here in Washington, and welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
Also with us is Jeffrey Rosen, an associate professor at George Washington University's Law School and legal affairs editor at the New Republic magazine. He's also on the phone with us, this time from Galesburg, Illinois. And Jeffrey, always good to have you on the program, no matter where it is.
Very good to be here.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Jeffrey Rosen, why don't we start with you? Both sides here are claiming victory.
As well they might. I almost had the sense that I did after the Casey decision in 1989, when all of the interest groups lined up on the steps of the Supreme Court, prepared to recite their pre-prepared remarks, and both were left short by the substance of the decision. Now, of course, I don't know if Doug and I will do much better, having just had a couple hours to digest it, but I'm struck by how unequivocal an affirmation of the Bakke decision this is. The one thing that I and lots of people had feared most is that the court would just muck it up all the more, that Justice O'Connor, for example, would write an opinion trying to satisfy both sides, giving victory to both sides, but essentially just confusing the law further. And at least from my first reading of these decisions, she's done the opposite. It's a clear, unequivocal affirmation of the core of the Bakke decision, which held that diversity in higher education is a compelling interest. But she also took seriously Justice Powell's injunction that race has to be a plus factor. It can be used as part of competitive consideration of an applicant, but it can't be used as the decisive factor. So the obvious distinction between the program that was struck down, which gave an automatic 20-point boost to undergraduate applicants, and the law school's more supposedly flexible program didn't satisfy the dissenters. And, of course, the opponents of this decision will say, well, we've had 25 years of Bakke, and it turns out that affirmative action, as it's actually practiced, can't be reconciled with the effort to achieve intellectual diversity because of the persistent score gaps and so forth. Race, as the dissenters today said, will always be the decisive factor rather than a plus factor. But what's so striking about this decision is that five unequivocal votes, not like Bakke, where the lower courts were undecided about whether Justice Powell had even gotten any single vote, let alone his own, here five members of the Supreme Court say, yes, race in higher education is a compelling interest. It may be used in a flexible program, and it essentially encourages universities to do it right. So lots more to say, but the one thing I did not get from the court today is any sort of equivocation or punting of this extremely difficult issue.
Doug Kamek, would you remind us of the Bakke decision and how these decisions today relate to it?
Well, Bakke was a decision dealing with the University of California Davis Medical School, and they had set aside a specific number of spots in their class. I think it was 16 spots in their class that were only available to minority applicants. The court struck down that particular program, indicating that that was, in essence, a quota, and it was particularly offensive because everyone wasn't competing against everyone else for all of the spots available in the class. So it was clear to the University of Michigan that they had to avoid setting aside any particular number of positions, either in their graduate school or in their undergraduate school. But Justice Powell, either writing for himself, and here's where academics disagree and some of the courts disagree, perhaps writing for a few other members of the court as well, articulated the view that race, even though it couldn't be used in the way the University of California at Davis had used it, might be a plus factor. It might, in the context of a particularized, individualized review of an applicant, be a tipping point. Sort of like he analogized life on the farm, that an applicant who brought with him that those unique perspectives from an agricultural community might be brought into a class by virtue of that experience, so too unique racial experience or ethnic experience might be counted. And university and law school administrators have been trying to figure out exactly what that means. And of course, some institutions made it mean a kind of two-track admission system where there was one set of credentials for white and Asian students and another set of credentials for preferred minorities. I think it's pretty clear that the court is not going to accept that kind of overt preference. But I think Jeffrey is right. A majority of the court has now accepted Justice Powell's perhaps lone proposition in Bakke that race can be a plus factor if it is applied with sensitivity, if it is applied in a holistic review of an individual file, and it's not a dispositive factor.
So, Jeffrey Rosen, in short, can we come away with this feeling that affirmative action is still the law of the land?
Well, universities can breathe a sigh of relief and are much less on tenterhooks than they were yesterday. One thing that they won't feel as much pressure to do is what the Bush administration had urged them to do and what Justice O'Connor in her majority opinion, as well as Justice Ginsburg in some of her separate opinions, explicitly repudiated. The Bush administration, joined by some conservatives, had said there is a third way. You don't have to uphold affirmative action. You don't have to strike it down across the board. You can seek race-neutral alternatives, such as the so-called 10% plans in Texas that automatically admit the kids in the top 10% of any high school to undergraduate admissions. And the court rejected that. It said that it's not constitutionally required that you adopt these race-neutral alternatives, and indeed they might be damaging to educational quality. It might ensure the admission of white and black students who are less qualified across the board than those students that they're displacing. Justice Thomas had the most fascinating dissenting decision in the law school case. He starts off by quoting Frederick Douglass, "What should you do to the Negro?" He says, "The only thing that we ask is that you let us alone." And he really went on to say, I thought quite in an intuitive way, that what the university is arguing for is the ability to have a first-rate, an elite institution. He's saying if we're prohibited from these preferences, then they'll feel pressure to have lottery standards or open admission. And he said, in my view, that kind of educational excellence is not a compelling interest. Look at how few lawyers in Michigan are actually serving and practicing within Michigan. He was willing to embrace the position of the Bush administration and to say there's nothing special about having a super-duper law school, as Justice Scalia said in the oral argument. As long as there are these race-neutral alternatives, that will satisfy what everyone agreed was a compelling interest in educational diversity. But there were not five votes for that. There were not barely, I would say, three or perhaps four votes for that proposition. Now, the universities are not off the hook. As Justice Scalia said, of course, this is going to be an invitation to litigation. Some people will fight about the distinction between a hard preference and a soft preference, between a two-track system and a holistic review. But the truth is that we've been fighting about that for 25 years since Bakke, and there's less uncertainty. There's less of a pincher around universities now that the sword of Damocles has been lifted and everyone acknowledges, even the conservative justice acknowledge, that diversity is a compelling interest for the purpose of higher education. So, of course, and I just would say this last thing. There was something remarkable about this Supreme Court case, wasn't there? Because, in a sense, the political branches had come to some kind of stasis about affirmative action. It wasn't allowed in Texas and California. It was in the East. The bills were no longer being introduced in Congress to ban it. All of a sudden, because the Supreme Court operates about 5 years after all the other branches, this case came up, and there was no special zeal on the part of lots of universities or even on the part of the Bush administration to press this point and to see what a clear constitutional rule would embrace. And what the court didn't do, which lots of people feared it might have done, was force everyone to go back to square one, rethink their admissions programs, try to write them to satisfy Justice O'Connor. That didn't happen. I mean, if I were a university lawyer, I would basically say, Bakke now has teeth, but it always did. We'll assume that, you know, on the margins, that's going to be taken seriously, but we're in a much more secure position today than we were yesterday.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We're speaking with Doug Kamek of Catholic University and Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington, and we're talking about today's Supreme Court rulings in two cases involving affirmative action and the University of Michigan. Let's get a question from Gerald, who joins us on the line from Detroit.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I had a question about the historical background of affirmative action programs. I want to know if there's a historical, if it's a historical fact that schools like the University of Michigan or Harvard, which is a private school, but universities in general have discriminated against minorities. I think there was an article in the Detroit Free Press about the oldest living African-American alumni of the school. His name's William McLean. He went to U of M Law School in the 1930s, and he was the only African-American in his class that entered in the class and graduated. So I was wondering if that's why affirmative action programs exist.
Well, Doug Kamek, are affirmative action programs, they are designed to redress the problems of the past, correct?
Well, actually not. And that's the remarkable thing that Jeffrey and I have been talking about, that the university wanted to argue this case on the grounds that they could use race even though there was no history, no showing of prior discrimination. It was well-settled law that race could be used as a basis for governmental remedy to overcome prior discrimination, as in the school desegregation cases. But there was no history of that here in the University of Michigan. And
what about other colleges like Harvard, Catholic University?
I
really want to know that, because that's, if there was a history of discrimination against, if they only let one person in who's black, and apparently in the case of the alumni I just mentioned, that was the case in the 30s.
Right.
It would make sense that these programs should then exist, because...
Well, let's hear from Doug Kamek on the basis of how they did argue the case.
Well, they argued on the basis that diversity itself was a compelling interest because it promoted cross-cultural understanding, that it promoted learning outcomes, that it prepares us to and our students to work in a diverse workforce. So on very different grounds than discrimination. And there probably is evidence of discrimination. Of course, we have the famous cases, of governors standing in schoolhouse and university doors in the 1950s. But this case was not argued on those grounds, and that's what makes it precedent-setting. But all of those questions, does the use of race actually promote learning outcomes? Does it actually result in effective performance in the workforce and in the international community, are likely to be the questions that are factual and that are going to be litigated in the years ahead as people nibble around the edges of this particular outcome.
Gerald, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take more of your questions, and when we come back from a short break, we're also going to be talking with two people intimately involved with today's decisions. The president of Bowdoin College will join us. How will this change their admissions policies, if at all? And also, and a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights will discuss how this might affect other areas of life, including civil boardrooms and including admissions policies at the service academies, West Point and the Air Force Academy and the Naval Academy. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about today's Supreme Court decisions on affirmative action in higher education in two cases involving the University of Michigan, one involving its undergraduate school and one involving the law school. The Supreme Court issued two different decisions. One said that the undergraduate's policy of granting minority applicants 20 points for their minority status alone. That amounted to a racial quota and was unconstitutional. In the law school case, however, the Supreme Court found that its use of race as one factor among many was permitted and upheld the principles of affirmative action. We're speaking with Doug Kamek, who's at the Catholic University Law School, and Jeffrey Rosen, who's an associate professor at George Washington University's Law School, about the decision. And our next caller is Erica, who's on the line with us from Kansas City, Missouri.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
I'm an African-American attorney, and quite frankly, I'm giddy and elated right now. I graduated from law school in 2000. My question is, what effect, if any, do your experts think this decision will have on the state legislation in California prohibiting the California state schools from considering race?
Jeffrey Rosen, you want to try that?
Very interesting question. That legislation prohibiting anyone from considering race in California was a reaction to the initiative in California which banned affirmative action. After Proposition 209 passed and universities were formally forbidden from taking race into account, lots of its supporters were frustrated by the fact that the university administrators seemed to be trying to go around the decision, coming up with socioeconomic preferences or taking race into account without saying so explicitly, or resorting to these holistic evaluations which would look at the success people had in overcoming discrimination, but really using that as a proxy for race. So it was their frustration with the political pressure to achieve diversity at all costs that led to the introduction of this bill that you're asking about, prohibiting people from even knowing race, from even asking about it in official forms. There was an interesting debate, and there is one in California, among conservatives about whether that was a good idea. And people like Abigail Thernstrom, one of the most distinguished opponents of affirmative action, said, this is a bad bill because I'm a social scientist, and it's not possible for me to do my job if I don't at least know race. That'll prevent me from monitoring the university and making sure it's complying with Proposition 209. I would think that to the degree that this decision takes the pressure off at the national level on affirmative action and basically gives universities more wiggle room, it may reduce the pressure for a bill like that to pass. But, of course, California is still free to adopt a stronger colorblind rule than the federal government, and Proposition 209 will remain in effect. So the same people who think that you've got to resort to this sort of guerrilla warfare to stop race from coming in through the back door will still continue to press their case. But broadly, the political context has changed, and maybe the need for that will seem a little less pressing.
Erica,
thank you.
Could you just explain a little bit why you're giddy? Did you think affirmative action was going to be struck down altogether?
You know, when I was in law school, I remember arguing in moot court this very issue. And arguing the Bakke decision, it was so nebulous, and you just couldn't really, I mean, we don't have a plurality. We have a decision, and I did think it was going to turn out differently. I called my sister, who's an attorney in Detroit, and we were celebrating. We were really excited.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Doug Kamek, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the politics of this. The decision upholding the law school's affirmative action policy was 5-4. The decision striking down the undergraduate school's decision was 6-3. Sandra Day O'Connor was described as the swing vote in both, but certainly she took at least one more justice along with her in the undergraduate case.
Well, she did, but the undergraduate case, of course, was more naturally allied with the conservative perspective insofar as it was the weaker case. It was the weaker factual case, and as a result, it's not surprising that the Chief Justice would want to write that case and that he would be joined by both Justice O'Connor and Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, and also that we would see Justice Breyer joining in part, because the overt preference in the undergraduate case was so far away from what Justice Powell had described in Bakke as individualized or particular review. I don't want to take away from Erica's giddiness, but I think we have to remember that in this particular case, the law school was presumed to be in good faith, and one of the things that the court points out is if there is any showing to the contrary that in fact what they're running is a two-track admission system where one set of criteria are applied to one racial group and a different set to another, that strict scrutiny will come back ever stronger at that point, and that will be unacceptable even if it is disguised with individualized review.
We're going to ask Doug Kamek and Jeffrey Rosen to sit aside for a while. We'll be back later in the program to take more of your questions with them. But we wanted to talk with two people who are involved in today's decision. Joining us now is Barry Mills, president of Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. He's on the phone with us from his office there on campus. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for inviting me.
And also joining us is Pete Cursino, a member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, a practicing attorney. He's with us by phone from his office in Cleveland, Ohio. And welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
President Mills, you've made racial diversity a priority in your admissions office there at Bowdoin College. How do you see these decisions today affecting what you do?
Well, we're really delighted with all the qualifications we've heard up till now with this decision, because it really does allow us to continue in almost every way what we do here at Bowdoin. We, I think, are the definition of whatever the holistic approach is, and we apply it very, very carefully in looking at every individual who applies to Bowdoin. We get about 5,000 applications every year, and we have an admissions office that reads every single application, including the recommendations and the essays that are submitted, so that we really know all of our applicants quite well. And this method of admissions that we use allows us to take race into account, among many other factors that we take into account. So we are quite happy with the decision, and delighted in many ways that Justice O'Connor has, in rather convincing ways, supported Justice Powell's decision and in arguments. And with 25 years of experience, although there is no roadmap, it is quite gratifying to us to know that what we do, I think, in many ways represents exactly what she's describing.
Pete Cursino, what about you? You were a critic of University of Michigan's affirmative action policies. What do you think of today's decisions?
Today's decision is contrary to prevailing 14th Amendment jurisprudence of the Supreme Court. It's inconsistent with Adirond. It's inconsistent with Richmond versus Croson. But we have a decision. And the decision is one that says that diversity, however you define it, and it's still an amorphous definition, even if you look at the law school definition of what diversity is a compelling state interest. Again, that's contrary to the strict scrutiny analysis that the court has employed. But what's interesting is the majority opinion in the Grutter case, the law school's case, does have some concern about the narrow tailoring aspect of this. Even though it's blessed it from the standpoint of being narrowly tailored to serve the compelling interest, it is contrary to its initial analysis or its previous analysis as to what constitutes narrow tailoring, that is, being finite in scope and time. This one has no definite ending point, which is contrary also to its previous cases in, that would require that where there's a finding of actual past discrimination, a remedy for that must also be finite in time. But what the court says here is it fully expects that in 25 years, these kinds of classifications will be unlawful. So in other words, there is not a deadline there because it's not hard and fast, and the court is not a legislature, presumably, that says we've got a sunset period for diversity programs or racial preference programs in 25 years. But the dissents picked up on that also and says that we fully expect that, yes, this will end in 25 years, if not sooner. So as I think a previous guest of yours said, there's something in the opinion that requires further scrutiny in terms of when it is that the Michigan program will finally terminate. And it may be that the program can go on infinitum, but it surely doesn't appear that way.
Let me ask President Mills there at Bowdoin College. You've said diversity is extremely important to you. Can you explain to us a little bit about why, and is it so important that, as was suggested in Justice Ginsburg's writings today, that had this affirmative action been struck down, that you would have found another way to do the same thing?
Well, it's important to us, located in Brunswick, Maine, Maine being probably the least diverse, least racially diverse state in the country. We're a national liberal arts college, and it's our goal really to create an environment for our students and our faculty and alums that represents what America looks like in the views and intellectual environment that people from across America can experience. So although we continue to have a very strong commitment to students from the state of Maine, it's really important to us that we have an intellectual community that represents what America looks like. Secondly, we're a public trust, and we view ourselves as a place that trains and educates leaders. So George Mitchell, Bill Cohen, Ken Chenault all went to Bowdoin. And what we are trying to do, as Justice O'Connor writes about, is train the leaders or educate the leaders of America. And so for both those reasons, it's important. Would we have found another way to get there? We care about educating first-generation college students. We care about socioeconomic diversity as well as racial diversity. So would we have found a way to create that diversity if the decision had gone the other way? I am sure that we would have attempted to find ways, but it's much easier today, with race being determined to be a factor that we can take into account, to really reach the goals that we are attempting to reach.
Pete Cursino, this decision goes beyond just universities. Can you describe for us briefly what effects you may think it has outside of the outside of academe?
This gives a little bit of a guidepost to preference programs that may be utilized by businesses and, for example, training programs, also possibly racial or ethnic designed scholarship programs. The bottom line here is we know from the dual decisions that you can't utilize an overt numerical sort of preference. There has to be something more amorphous, more subjective, very much more particularized, and race can only be a plus factor. Now, what does that mean? Well, I defy anybody to give us a precise definition of what that means, but we know it's something less than what the Michigan undergrad program requires and something around the lines of what the law school program does, if we can figure out exactly what they do. Because if you read the decision, it's significant in that you never really get, even when you look at the underlying evidence at the lower courts, how it is that the law school, regardless of how it uses race as a flexible factor, always seems to arrive at the same percentage of minorities, that is 12%, year in and year out. But regardless of how it does that, now if businesses and others can take a look at how that model works, they can utilize that to try to insulate them from assault from anyone who believes that they've been discriminated against on the basis of race.
We're speaking with Pete Cursino, who's an attorney and a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and with Barry Mills, who's the president of Bowdoin College, about the decisions today in the Supreme Court of the United States. And they were basically upholding affirmative action, but limiting its use. It struck down the point system that it was used in the undergraduate program, but upheld the more holistic use of race as one factor among many in the University of Law School admissions policy. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get back to the phones. Our next caller is Bruce, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about the wisdom of using race as a proxy for diversity. For example, if I'm on the admissions committee and I decide to admit Jesse Jackson as opposed to Walt Williams or Thomas Sowell, have I really used race appropriately? Just to say that because a person is an African American, they think a particular way, I think is just wrong.
Well,
what's going on here?
Barry Mills, that seems like a question to you.
I didn't mean to imply that merely because someone is of a particular race, they represent a particular view. What we do in our admissions is we really evaluate each student and their experiences and their potential. And what you find is when you admit different people from different places across America, what you'd bring is, in some ways, a sense of different views that reflect these people's experiences. And so you're absolutely correct. Race in and of itself does not define different views by definition. But what we try to do is fashion a class that brings many different views from across America and, frankly, the world. So you can create diversity in all different kinds of ways, socioeconomically, geographically, in terms of where people grew up and what their race is, certainly has an effect. But you can create diversity in all sorts of ways, and I didn't mean to suggest by any means that race in and of itself creates diversity. What we're looking for are diverse people.
But it seems that this decision is going to make race the deciding factor when, in fact, you're not really certain that you've achieved diversity just because you have a spectrum of hues of different colored people on a campus that doesn't really accomplish, necessarily doesn't accomplish anything. What the Supreme Court's done is said you can use one factor to achieve another factor, but is there a link between those two factors?
Well, there is a link. The question is how strong is that link? And so what this allows us to do is to use race as one of the factors that we use in creating diversity, but it is not the only factor that we use. So the decision allows us the latitude to consider it as one of the factors and doesn't actually ask us to put blinders on when we read 5,000 applications and we actually know where people come from and what they're about.
Bruce, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's get another question, this one from Denise, who's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, Neil, thank you for accepting my call.
Sure.
My question is I just stay amused and confused as why race would not be considered the factor. Because in this country, that's what's been the factor to deny black people full citizenship in this country. And then when it comes to remedies, then race should not be the factor. And so what is it that we cannot address America's historical race problem? And until we discuss that in sincerity and understanding that there have been wrongs committed to a people, we're not going to ever change, and we'll always be arguing about this question.
Well, let's get a response from Pete Cursino.
Well, that goes to the rationale for the University of Michigan's program. The curious thing about University of Michigan's program, and that at almost every other institution in the country that employs preference programs, has absolutely nothing to do with what the caller was talking about, that is, to remedy past discrimination. If you are, in fact, remedying past discrimination, that is truly a compelling state interest, and the court has found that. That's justifiable. No ifs, ands, or buts. Nobody debates that. End of story. But here we've got institutions that have never been adjudged to have discriminated in the past, employing it for purposes of, it may be a social good, but is it constitutional? And the court has decided that it is constitutional. So going back to what the caller had to say, if you find discrimination, you can remedy that. There is nothing that prohibits that. The court has already determined that remediation of past discrimination is, in fact, a compelling state interest. But that's not what this is about. What Michigan and other schools are articulating as their rationale for having preference programs is that it presents a diversity of viewpoints. So there are individuals who will get plus points solely by virtue of their pigment of their skin, even though they have never themselves ever been the victims of discrimination, nor...
Well, Pete Cursino, I'm afraid we're going to have to let it go there. Pete Cursino is a member of the U.S. Civil Commission on Civil Rights. Also, thanks to the president of Bowdoin College. Back after a break. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing today's rulings on affirmative action at the University of Michigan by the Supreme Court. Two decisions, one in the undergraduate case by a 6-3 margin. The Supreme Court said its system of admissions using race as a factor. Undergraduate students who were members of minorities were given 20 points on their system. That was a racial quota and unconstitutional. That the law school's admissions policy, however, which used race as part of one factor among many in a so-called holistic approach, that was constitutional, that it was possible to use race as one factor in achieving diversity, and that was constitutional. So a split decision that appears to uphold affirmative action, though limited. Our guests again are Doug Kamek, who's the dean of the Catholic University Law School, and Jeffrey Rosen, associate professor at George Washington University's Law School. And we're going to get back to your questions. But Jeffrey Rosen, I wanted to ask you, I'm sure you were listening when Pete Cursino was talking, the member of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, saying that he thought that this was unconstitutional.
Well, principled conservatives have argued this for the past 25 or 30 years. They believe that the Constitution is colorblind and that it doesn't make sense to make an exception for universities. As Pete Cursino said, why is it impermissible in public contracting and in all sorts of areas except for higher education? And one thing that's remarkable about this decision is that that position got, I suppose, four votes at most, and at least for now appears to be dead. In the litigation, the Bush administration didn't really support it. It tried to come up with an alternative. And if I were a principled conservative like Pete Kersenow, and I respect his position, and Doug Kamek, I'd imagine, is closer to him than I am, I would be feeling a great sense of frustration that after 25 years, this position that I've been pressing so hard really lost in a way that will have great practical consequences. One other thing that was interesting is that Justice Breyer's vote is interesting here. It was 6-3, and one has a sense it's a self-consciously pragmatic decision. One almost had the sense that the court didn't want to do what Bakke did, issue a splinter decision that was not clear about how many votes that it had and that might have bad practical consequences. Breyer and O'Connor, who voted together in many important cases, including voting rights cases, seem to have driven the court toward this more pragmatic, more moderate position. And the result is that when I compare this to abortion and gay rights, all the most controversial culture war decisions, just as a purely practical matter, this is a cleaner, crisper, easier to understand decision than many of those other ones. It's not as fractured. There aren't as many disagreeing parts. So it was a clean defeat for Pete Kersenow's colorblind position. And at least we know what the law is. And at least for 25 more years, which is what the court tells us we've got, we can follow the law of the land.
Well, how about it, Doug Kamek? Are you frustrated?
No, I'm not frustrated. I don't think it's a defeat for the colorblind Constitution. I think that is our aspiration. I think that's been our aspiration from the time of the founding, at least from the time that we added the Equal Protection Clause through the 14th Amendment. The question is how you get there. And I think one of the things that has always been in debate is there a obligation on the part of public entities to represent the society as a whole. And I think the court is saying here, through narrowly tailored means, that can be accomplished. But I want to underscore that narrowly tailored part of it. The court says that several times, that they hope to see a colorblind society in no more than 25 years. They want to make sure that universities and law schools are not being duplicitous, that we're going to presume good faith, but we're going to apply strict scrutiny if we understand that they're playing a game with us, if this is just a sham. And I think we have to be careful about what the effects of not playing this ruling out fairly is. Mm-hmm. I think the court's understanding is no methodical, mechanical admissions based merely on race as a factor. Rather, you can look for individualized experience and viewpoint, and some of that viewpoint, some of that experience is based in race, based in economic condition, but don't just use race or skin color to decide. That would contradict the basic precepts of equal protection. And I don't think Jeffrey disagrees with that, and I think the court has held on to that, even with this opinion.
I don't disagree, but Doug, isn't it poignant? I agree. I think you put it very well. But that's more or less what Justice Powell thought that he was embracing 25 years ago. He said, I mean it when I say be honest about this. Narrow tailoring means narrow tailoring. And he also thought that it would end. There's a remarkable passage in the biography of Justice Powell by Dean Jeffries at Virginia, where Powell and Justice Marshall are talking, when will these preferences end? Powell said they'll just go on for 15 years, right? Marshall says they'll be necessary for another 100 years. And Powell was shocked. And there's this elegiac quality, the same elegiac quality in this opinion, where Justice Ginsburg no less says, yes, 25 years is enough. And Justice O'Connor, who asked this twice at oral argument, when will they end, says, surely 25 years is enough. I wonder, I think, Doug, maybe you'll even agree with me that the principle that the court embraces, that diversity is good because it helps people live in a multicultural society that expects that institutions will look like America, that principle doesn't have a stopping point. And predictions are silly, but if I had to bet, I would think in 25 years, when the court revisits this question, we'll find a public opinion democracy that demands even more of this representational quality in its public institutions. So if I were a colorblind conservative, and as I am a moderate liberal who's, you know, only reluctantly embracing these programs as, in my view, the lesser of several evils, I'm not at all optimistic. I don't share the court's optimism that in 25 years we'll have overcome this terrible scourge that makes it so difficult to achieve equal educational outcomes. And I think in some ways it's not even clear how far we've come in the past 30 years since Bakke. We still have the same aspirations for overcoming race, but not a clear vision of exactly how to do it.
I know you want to come back on this, Doug Kamek, but I wanted to put it in the context of this email question we got from Roseanne Kahn in New York City. Won't these two decisions just cause quotas to go undercover, to be talked about in admissions committees, but not printed in policies?
Well, that's a nice opening, because that's exactly what I think a majority of the court is saying it cannot do. But I'm fearful that by giving approval to the University of Michigan program, that they might have signaled that, that they might have signaled that being covert and being subtle and, you know, we have to be honest here that it's more than mere coincidence that if you had a 160 on the LSAT and a 3.5, you had a 22% chance of being admitted if you were white and a 100% chance of being admitted if you were African American. There's something very frightening about that kind of disparity and dichotomy that is wrongful. Now, Justice O'Connor says, with a great deal of latitude and perhaps more trust than I would have given the university in this instance, says, we're going to presume good faith, but this is what we mean by good faith. You must demonstrate to us that you're looking at these students as individuals, that in fact learning outcomes, and this is where Jeffrey and I know as educators, are most concerned. Is this an opinion that really advances the objective of education, of improving the learning of individual students and making us more capable to work in a diverse workforce and a diverse culture? If that can be proven, and I think it has to be proven more specifically than the University of Michigan Law School has demonstrated, then I think this will be a salutary opinion. But if it's just a signal to be covert and clever and to come up with the same percentage year after year, just don't announce the percentage in advance, well, then that's not constitutional law. That's just simply being dishonest.
And Jeffrey Rosen, I'm sure, has a learned response to that, but we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. Doug Kamek, you just heard from, is Dean of Catholic University Law School, a former constitutional legal counsel to President Reagan. He was with us from his office here in Washington, and good to have you again.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And Jeffrey Rosen, associate professor at George Washington University's Law School and legal affairs editor at the New Republic magazine, was on the phone with us from Galesburg, Illinois. And Jeffrey, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
NPR News will have more details later on the Supreme Court's ruling on how race figures in the University of Michigan admissions process. Also today, U.S. civil administrators are moving ahead with plans for a grassroots political process in Iraq. But Iraqis are becoming increasingly impatient with the process. Those stories today from NPR's Nina Totenberg in Washington and NPR's Kate Seeley in Baghdad. You can hear them later today on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.